It's the Friending Pharma edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Green's Wi-Fi mistake, Friending Big Pharma, an interview with Jennifer Olette. Let's begin episode 127. Welcome to Radio Free Thinker, live on 101.9 FM and available through iTunes podcasting. This is Don, your free thinking historian, political scientist, and philosopher.
This is Jenna, your biochemist and microbiologist.
And this is Daniel, vice president of the UBC Freethinkers Club.
And you'll notice I took on an extra hat this week as historian because Ethan, unfortunately, is dying from some throat ailment. I hope he's not really dying. Our wishes go out to you, Ethan, for a speedy recovery.
And that means I have to run everything here, so...
If on occasion you see a oops or a bloops, it's all Daniel's fault.
Yes, it will be.
But speaking of bizarre people of the week, sorry, Ethan, I was reading a story this week that I thought was kind of interesting. I thought you folks might be interested to hear about it, too. It's about a gentleman named Richard Handel in Sweden. Apparently, Richard Handel was attempting to create in his kitchen, well, some form of energy device. And he sat there and he had got together some chemicals and all that, and he was cooking it up on his kitchen stove, and there was a bit of an explosion. So he thought, well, maybe I should just check with the authorities and make sure that everything I'm doing is legal and above board. So he phoned up the Swedish Nuclear Energy Commission.
I'm sorry, Don. I think you mean nuclear. Continue.
To find out whether what he was doing was legal. Apparently, Mr. Handel was attempting to create a fission atomic reactor in his kitchen. Apparently, he's not the first one to have done this. He gathered together some americium from people's smoke detectors and little radioactive stuff that's on the hands of some clocks, was boiling it together to purify the substance so as he could make an atomic reactor.
Are we totally sure he wasn't trying to cover up a meth lab after the explosion?
Well, no, because apparently there was actually radioactive cleanup to be done.
Okay.
He's not the first one to try and create a fission reactor. In the 1990s, David Hahn tried and failed to do so. Actually, there was a book written about him called The Radioactive Boy Scout. I'm not quite sure if radioactive and Boy Scout goes together, unless it's some kind of science fiction movie.
Sounds like a comic book.
How old was this Boy Scout, and is this a badge?
Well, actually, apparently to the stories, and I'm going to run on my memory here, so forgive me if I'm a little off, but yes, apparently he did get a badge in nuclear energy.
I'm letting it go.
And actually, rumor has it that in 2007, he was arrested, apparently to try to rekindle his reactor dreams. But that's not the bizarre part of the story. I mean, there are crazy people trying to do crazy things. When I was reading this particular article, at the very end, like the last little line of it, it mentioned that Handel was a member of a group, an exclusive group called the Fusioneers, one of 38 people to have successfully created a homemade fusion reactor. Now, of course, for those of you who know about nuclear energy, I won't say anymore. But for those of you who don't...
Please enlighten us.
The article, the editor of this article, made a slight mistake in that he confused fission reactor with fusion reactor. So a fission reactor is the kind we think of nuclear bombs, where you blow up. Fukushima in Japan was a fission reactor where you split atoms apart to create energy.
Very
bad. A lot of radioactivity, not good.
Very bad things tend to happen.
However, there's also a lot of energy being produced, so...
Exactly, which maybe is worth it. Fusion reactors, on the other hand, emulate our sun, in the sense that they take two atoms and they smash them together to create new energy. There's no radiation from this one, it's a relatively clean source. The problem, of course, with a fusion reactor is that the power in versus the power out ratio is, whenever they do it, they always put a lot more power into it than they ever get out of it. And of course, with fission reactors, the big problem is to try and keep the chain reaction going, which I guess in a homemade reactor is probably a good thing. But again, I was freaked out to find out that there are actually 38 people who created fusion, the safe kind, reactors at home, homemade ones. In fact, Mark Supps was a geek celebrity in 2010 when he went around sort of showing off his fusion reactor that he made in his spare time for like $50,000. Apparently he was a web designer during the day and a atomic scientist at night. But again, I just went, wow, they're like, when you think of, you know, the billions of dollars you spend on proper fusion reactors and the dangers at fission reactors, but there are people out there making homemade, and we're worried about Iran.
Well, I think there's a little less danger in fusion reactors than whatever Iran might be cooking up, but...
I'm still a little confused. So these people hypothetically actually produced workable fusion reactors?
Yes. Now, apparently, it's actually easy to get a design for a homemade version of a fusion reactor. Actually, apparently, the design most of them use is based, I think, on one that's about 1960s, 1950s. And again, it's not so much that it's hard to build this device and to get it to work. The trick of it is to get more energy out than you put into it.
So it's hot fusion.
Yes, as opposed to cold fusion, which is, Jenna?
Where you don't have to put that much energy in, i.e. heat. Therefore, you can get more energy out, like you were saying, than you need to put in.
Yeah,
although you don't, I mean, there's energy balance. Everything always needs to equal out, but as far as usable energy. In
hot fusion is one that's at millions of degrees. Cold fusion is one done at room temperature. And the
people are using millions of degrees in their kitchens?
Yeah, well, actually, to be fair, the... Mark Sipes one was in a warehouse.
Is someone exaggerating?
This all seems a little ridiculous.
I'm calling Hinky.
Speaking of ridiculous, why, oh why, Wi-Fi me? For those of you who keep tabs on the political scene, know that there was a historical first in our last election. Canada finally elected its first Green Member of Parliament. There was hopes that a more enlightened voice would be now heard on Parliament Hill.
Sadly, I was one of the people hoping for that.
Well, according to a recent tweet-isode, Elizabeth May voiced her concerns over electromagnetic frequencies. The Federal Green Party, along with the BC Greens, apparently are relying largely on studies done by Magda Havas, who apparently has just made a whole career out of saying, ooh, electromagnetic energy will kill you all. In fact, I don't know why we're not all dead now.
We really should be by that logic.
Yes.
Yes.
Although, of course, there is, again, sadly, or perhaps atypically, the Green Party does have actually a political agenda behind the particular posting that they're having right now, is that they're in opposition to wireless smart meters, which are set to be universal in British Columbia by 2012. So they're using the Wi-Fi, ooh, in your home, and it will be bad for you. Now, for those of you who don't know, and a little bit of a backgrounder, but not too much of one, your typical cell phone, which, again, was one of the things that she was railing about, transmits at about 1 to 3 watts. Your wireless router, your Wi-Fi that most of us are exposed to and that everyone is really paranoid about, at least in schools, is only about 1/500th of that power. Now, compare that to something like your microwave oven, which actually does do damage, which is like 1,000 watts. And watts matter. Your body is a barrier to radio waves. To penetrate your skin or beyond requires a minimum amount of energy. So let's use an example here. So if I was trying to break into my car to get some candy or some food or something, right? And I used 1 watt of energy. It's like me tapping on the window with a feather or something, right? I can tap there forever, and it's never going to go through the glass. Now, a microwave, which is using 1,000 watts, is like taking a large brick and smacking against that same window. The window will eventually crack and break, and you'll get in. But you get the same sort of trouble with cell phone and Wi-Fi. Is it's not even so much that the type of radiation can cause damage. It can. Heat can cause damage. It's only when there's too much of it that you actually have the risk. Small amounts is not bad.
And even then, certain wavelengths will just either go through people or just hit their skin and not actually penetrate. Like, I, for a while, I worked at cell phone towers. So I was, like, right under the big cell phone towers that shoot out probably thousands of watts worth of radio frequencies. And for the most part, I think I'm okay.
What about your other head? What does it have to say? No, well, actually, and that's a good point. And actually, I mean, cell phone towers are beginning to get up to levels that I might say, well, research is good. And we're not saying don't research it. In fact, I couldn't help but notice that on sort of the anti-Wi-Fi sort of side of the argument are largely political or activist groups on it, whereas on the other side seem to be largely scientists. If you look at the evidence that people tend to put forward to claim harm, they almost exclusively fall into either the test of principle type experiments, which is sort of say, well, there is something we can measure here, or they're the small scale studies, the studies that are like a decade or two older or longer. Some of the studies I saw them relying on were going back to the 50s, where our understanding of how this stuff works was really poor. And or they don't actually stand up to proper scientific procedures. And they're using this and they're sort of cherry-picking the data. I mean, we talked about here previously on a show about a scientist who detected increased metabolism in the brain related to cell phone use. But of course...
That's awesome.
But the problem of it was it was just increased metabolism rate, which wasn't that the radiation was penetrating the body. Again, almost every study that goes out there says it cannot get into it. It just showed that there was more blood flow in that area.
Yeah, the most that seems to happen with the cell phone, like, held up to your head is it'll heat the skin up that it's closest to a little bit.
Which it turns out a burrito will do, too.
Yes, and actually I imagine that heating you're dealing with, again, being a super scientist, not, is actually just insulation. I mean, if you put a phone up to your head, you're going to get insulation. So if you sit there and you feel it warm, remember, if you put anything up to your head that's an insulator, we'll insulate that.
Not to mention modern smartphones can get quite hot.
Yes. So even if we, and I hate to do this because people will take it out of context, but let's pretend just for the moment that there are some minor risks. There's always this cost-benefit analysis that goes on. I mean, let's face it, cars are one of the biggest risk factors in our society, and yet we drive cars all the time, and there are billions of ways that we can make cars more safe. I mean, one, we could reduce the speed limit to 5 miles an hour. We could allow computers to control cars, which has been my dream forever. And all sorts of things. But we sit there and say, well, okay, there's risks and there are benefits, and we weigh them out. These people are seriously arguing that we should essentially eliminate all forms of wireless communication in our society. And frankly, it would collapse. I mean, right now, you are getting bombarded, I believe, with far more electromagnetic frequencies, radiation, than you are from your cell phone from this radio broadcast. This radio broadcast is a 1,000-watt tower, right? Broadcasting out.
Something like that.
Actually, I think it's a lot more than 1,000 watts, but
yeah.
Again, our technical guru is not here today.
If Elizabeth May had her way, she'd want to shut us down.
Exactly, which is, again, something I'm sad about the Green Party.
Well, I think the other thing to remember is Elizabeth May, as you mentioned, is also a politician and not a scientist. So I think that her public comments about this type of issues are actually sort of more of a symptom of public unawareness in general of the science behind electromagnetic radiation like we've been talking about. So I don't think we should necessarily cut her personally down at the knees. After all, I know very, very little about law or creating or altering public policy or running a political campaign, and not everyone can know everything. Now, of course, a public official does have a responsibility to sort of know what they're spewing from their own mouth, but at the same time...
Do a little research, at least.
Well, actually, no, sorry to cut in there, but you mentioned a good point. We talked about this also in the show earlier, how you kind of get information bubbles, where, you know, Elizabeth May deals with a lot of people who are hyper-concerned about the environment. And on probably 8 out of the 10 issues, I would agree with them. But if you're in this environment where everyone who you're talking to says, X is bad, X is bad, you're going to get Wi-Fi is bad that gets into this information bubble. And if you can't break out of it, because again, that's one of the things about smart technology sometimes can create.
Well, and actually the same type of semi-ironclad paradigms can occur in the scientific community as well. So you do need to examine both sides of an issue, no matter who is looking at both sides of an issue. And I think that this type of symptom really is just sort of a reminder and a motivator to keep people that might be in the science side of things to make their voice heard.
I would agree with that. In fact, I don't think we should be complacent about it. I do think if people want to do research, great. But I think our response should be to the research. And right now, the research still is vastly in favor of not being freaked out about Wi-Fi, cell phones, etc. But we will return after this commercial break in one moment.
WinnieCooper.net presents Listen and Party with Kingdom Cloud and DJ Cam Dales, Saturday, August 13th at the Astoria. Don't tell anyone, but Listen and Party are the West Coast's best-kept secret, and their album, I Was Young, was one of the sleeper hits of 2010. Kingdom Cloud wear matching outfits and make it impossible not to smile and feel awesome while they play. Top it off with DJ Cam Dales, and you've got yourself a party, my friends. It's all going down Saturday, August 13th at the Astoria. Doors are at 9 and cover is $10. Sponsored by Beatroot Magazine and CITR 101.9.
And we're back. So that was very, very interesting commercial. And as you all know, we like it when we support the big mega corporations out there. And continuing on with that, we're going to talk about Big Pharma wants to be your friend.
Does that mean we're getting big checks or something?
Yes, yes, but they're being held in escrow, so we have to wait until we die before we get to collect them. So a 144 formal complaint was submitted to the U.S. Federal Trade Commission, prepared by four separate watchdog groups, citing dozens of examples where pharmaceutical marketing on the web has threatened consumer privacy and engaged in unfair and deceptive practices. One of the examples has testimony of a quote-unquote average mother who switched to a particular insulin injection system. The site is whyinsulin.com, and her testimony was one of many. However, what was not mentioned anywhere in the site is that her testimonial was paid, making the value of her real-life story somewhat suspect, or at least irrespective of whether it was true or not. People still should have been sort of aware that this was a paid testimonial as opposed to something that was genuine from the heart. And a lot of these websites are trying to go for that, I'm your friend, I know what you're going through, we've gone through this together, and in a sort of way being a faux friend. Another example, and perhaps a bit more disturbing in some ways, earlier this year, WebMD, one of the most visited health sites on the internet, came under fire for promoting an online depression test sponsored by Eli Lilly, makers of antidepressant Symbiote.
I'm sure that went well.
Well, according to a report on CBC's BNet.com, the tests were rigged so that no matter how you answered the 10 questions, it always came out, yes, you're depressed and you should seek out treatment.
I the thing I like about this is, imagine you just like purposely went through it to answer like everything as happy as possible. It's like, do you have trouble sleeping? No. Or do you generally find yourself happy? Yes. And it's like, you could be having depression.
Well, of course, because you're in denial.
Oh, yeah.
See? Yeah, it all works out that way. In June, the British Medical Journal cited a report in an article that suggests Big Pharma's online marketing activities pose a threat to public health. The report, Online Healthcare Advertising Needs Regulation, brought to light a growing number of people who are getting their medical information from Google and the little Google ads that pop up when you do searches, and that in the absence of an effective regulation scheme, that these online ads pose a real and serious threat to public health. This, of course, is just one of many examples of growing direct-to-customer advertising that Big Pharma is pursuing. Now, of course, I do believe that patients should be informed about what they're going on. I mean, doctors are there to be sort of the wise and sort of directing you, but you should not necessarily be ignorant into what they're doing to you or for you. But there's actually no regulation, effective regulation on the internet. And more troubling is the growing movement among companies to create quote-unquote AstroTurf websites that provide both health information and support, but are really just fronts for corporate advertising. Now, for those people who aren't acquainted with what the term AstroTurf means, it's a variation of the idea of a grassroots. Now, grassroots is supposed to be from, you know, people, real people on the street and the community, whatever, coming together, growing together like grass grows everywhere, and actually creating a movement.
And AstroTurf just looks like grass.
Exactly. It's all artificial. One of the examples of one of these faux patient communities is a website called Accidental Sisterhood, which I think is a little condescending. Wait for it. At first sight, it looks like something an amateur would put together. The site purports to be a gathering place, in quotes, for incontinent women created by a urologist. But the educational section directs everyone to go to Medtronic's InterStim Therapy for bladder control. Of course, what's not mentioned anywhere on the website is that the doctor who created this website is actually a partner in this company, and the whole thing is just a marketing scheme to get people in there. Now, of course, another big issue that comes up with this is the internet is a big, big place. And there are some regulations as far as medical advertising, but it has to be directed in country. And when you have companies that can advertise anywhere in the world and you still get it in this particular country, a lot of those regulations become essentially ineffective. Current stats show that 80% of people go online for medical advice and over 20% seek support groups. Big Pharma is gearing up to friend and tweet these people. Pharma marketing groups like doseofdigital.com have listed over 350 examples of online health forums and YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook page run by drug companies.
Yeah, there's also like a big thing in marketing nowadays is they'll hire someone on Twitter who basically sort of scans for certain keywords and then will respond to people. Like, I've had it happen to me with like random things. I think TransLink did it once. Sometimes it can be helpful, but sometimes it's kind of creepy.
Well, you know, according to a 2010 report by Pharma Marketing News, I didn't know they called themselves pharma. I thought that was a disparaging word.
I know.
Yeah, okay.
Short for pharmaceutical.
Yeah, yes. Imagine they called themselves Big Pharma News.
Could do. But anyhow, according to Big Market...
according to Big Pharma Marketing News,
there are hundreds of patients in social networking groups earning thousands of dollars from drug companies providing, quote-unquote, real patient stories as part of online branding of drugs and drug awareness campaigns. Novartis, one of the big companies in the world, stated that social marketing is an important means of providing an important channel, to better understand the needs of patients. However, it was recently reprimanded for including a Facebook share button, which is quite common. I mean, everyone's got, hey, share on Facebook, for its leukemia medication. The Federal Drug Administration ruled that this particular Facebook widget provided misleading shared content because it failed to disclose the serious risks that are associated with this drug. Again, because of the way our social media works, we do everything sort of halfway, right? We kind of go, oh, that looks kind of interesting, and we look, and then we don't actually investigate deeply. And these websites are actually preying upon our inability to concentrate and focus on any one thing. I blame the younger generation. That being said, regardless of the...
Those six-year-olds.
But regardless of the ethics of it, social media does work. Recent research has suggested that patients who ask for a medication by name have about 50 to 75% chance of walking out of the doctor's office with that prescription, irregardless of the doctor's inclination about it. So if you go in, you ask a doctor, hey, I'm feeling depressed, could you please prescribe me a medication? Odds are they're just going to prescribe it for you.
Yeah, I mean, why argue with you? We'll just give it to you.
Exactly.
Well, and there's also the question sort of between the name brand and the generic brand of these medications, many of which are sort of duplicates at the same time. If a patient asks for a name brand...
why not?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this just goes to the idea that, you know, direct marketing to people has its has its benefits. But if it's about a particular topic that you're not actually well-versed on, I mean, again, to be a well-informed patient is one thing, but to prescribe your own medication is an entirely different thing, because, again, that's why doctors spend years and years and years in medical schools and stuff.
Well, and aside from just the issues of sort of self-directed medication versus professional-directed medication, it seems like one of the major issues is proper disclosure. So, I mean, if we're getting tweets that say that they're from, you know, Merck, I don't know if that's a pharmaceutical company or a company, chemical company.
Pfizer.
Yeah. You know, we're going to understand that that's coming from them. But when we're talking about these AstroTurf websites and different websites that are ostensibly from a more grassroots or, you know, hypothetically unbiased source, then that seems a little bit more nefarious, because obviously they're avoiding the disclosure that's going to help you to rationally evaluate the information you're being presented with.
Yeah, no, and actually, you know, it even gets more complicated than that in one degree. One of the podcasts I was listening to had mentioned that there's a iPhone app, I think it's an iPhone app, marketed towards doctors to help them pick the right drug for their patient. Now, part of the, like, this is a free service provided by the app developers. In order to pay for it, there's all this drug company advertising on there. And one of the issues that was raised about that is that, you know, they're advertising to the doctor to prescribe medication that the doctor isn't actually going to use, but is going to give to a patient. So sort of the consequences of their decisions are not really borne on them. They're borne on their patients. And as long as, I guess, the patient doesn't die, there's this idea that, you know, they may be willing to go for something that's subprime versus prime just because, well,
it's that's what the app told you.
Well,
until very recently, there was a lot more motivation than that. I mean, for medical conferences and whatnot, it used to be standard practice for drug companies and drug reps and whatnot to sponsor dinners and vacations and different things for a physician's entire family in an attempt to influence his or her prescribing patterns. And again, especially when we're talking about generic versus name brand medications that are essentially exactly the same compound. So, you know, hasn't been outlawed for actually that long. I believe it's sometime within this decade that has been, at least in Canada, not so much kosher anymore. So the marketing to doctors has actually become a lot less motivational just with an iPad app than a fancy steak.
Well, and you know, that's the other thing too that plays into all of this. I mean, for anyone who's watched commercials on TV, we know that the point of a commercial is not to inform you. It is to sort of brainwash you.
Persuade you.
Well, not even persuade. I mean, the psychologist in psychology that's being used in modern commercials is designed to bypass your logic centers and to actually motivate you on a sort of subconscious sort of level.
The psychological term for it is secondary route to persuasion, I believe.
Excellent. And so if you're buying a car or if you're going out to buy cereal, right? I mean, that's one level of, okay, you're playing with my brain in a way that I don't really understand, but what's the harm? But when these ads are directed to me for medical information, or worse, to doctors for medical information, and I can't help but think that they won't go down the slippery road to use these secondary marketing techniques in the same area, that the risks are scary.
Yes, they are.
So we have on scary news. We're going to freak everyone out here because apparently we're living in a bizarro world. As everyone knows, me as a good Marxist-Leninist sort of communist believe in state control and the state should, you know, be in charge of everything. And Daniel, as your sort of hippie libertarian, thinks, oh no, free speech and everyone should be allowed to say whatever they want. Well, on this particular issue, we seem to have reversed roles. Federal scientists unfairly silenced, according to Union. Christine Miller, a researcher at Department of Fisheries and Ocean, research focused on the decline of salmon stocks. In January, she was the lead author on an article in the Journal of Science that suggested the numbers are dropping in sockeye salmon in BC's Fraser River, and that this may be due to a viral infection. Reporters lined up to interview her, but the federal government stepped in and said, nope, you're not allowed to talk. You are a federal employee, and as such, you are not allowed to give your publicly paid for information to the public. Christine Miller was banned from discussing her work with the media, a federal government scientist. Their work funded by, well, that's just what I said. Sorry. Gary Colbert, not related to Stephen Colbert, I'm sure, president of the Professional Institute of Public Servants of Canada, said that their work doesn't jibe with policies the government wants. They simply asked them to stay quiet, and they don't want them to be hired either. Essentially, the union is saying that the federal government is either muzzling scientists from speaking what they've done on their research, or they're not even hiring them in the first place if they think there's going to be sort of a risk to this. What they do is absolutely essential for the public, and they should be able to protect the public good. So, in this particular instance, I think that she had something to say. It was in her field of study. It was in a peer-reviewed publication. Why should she not have been able to say this? We're going to let our ex-Daniels pointing desperately not to speak. Jenna, you have some relationship to science and research and stuff.
Some kind of science or research and stuff. And really, I think there's a couple of distinctions that the story fails to make. And as well as using the word muzzling fairly ubiquitously in everything that I've read about this story, not particularly helpful. So, firstly, I don't think this scientist is being prevented from sharing her science as she published it as science in a paper called Science. And she published the science.
And this is, I mean, not accessible to everyone, but accessible to a large number of people who could disseminate its
information. Well, I think that it's just about as, I mean, it's absolutely as accessible to the general public versus the reporters as she is herself. So either way, it's going to go through a reporter.
I would disagree with that. Sorry. Now, why? Jenna, don't hit me. Please. Please put it down. Put it down. Okay. I think the difference you have here, and again, maybe because you're in the field, is you're right. So Science has released this article, but in order for it to gain legs, as they say, the interview process is part of it, where you do the interview, it adds to the story, it's more likely to be published in the lower papers as opposed to the scientific ones, and so the actual information to be disseminated to real people is almost contingent upon doing an interview for these articles. But whereas if it's only published in Science, sure, the academia will know of it, but the actual public itself will largely remain ignorant.
I'm absolutely in agreement with you that it needs to go into another news source. However, in a perfect world, I completely agree with you that...
Good, that's the end of our show.
However, there's a problem as far as having people in science talk to people in mainstream media, and that is that things tend to get really confused. So for myself, I've actually been interviewed by mainstream news media.
About science.
About my science. And then, you know, I gave the interview and I sat down to listen to the report, and by goodness... First off, I came off looking really good. By the end of that interview, I was single-handedly curing tuberculosis.
Have you actually single-handedly cured
that
tuberculosis?
That would be the problem with the program, is that, no, in fact, that's not even a close approximation to the truth. So I can understand why the government would be nervous about having one of their scientists, who's actually probably fairly media naive, talking to a media-centered person who's used to spinning the story any which way. I mean, the government hires PR people that are media savvy for a purpose so that they can do the spinning. And I'm pretty sure they're not going to relinquish that power to any news media to be able to spin however they want to sell their papers.
No, like, certainly some aspect of this might be that the government doesn't like what this researcher is saying. Mm-hmm. But also, without a doubt, some of it is they don't want it spun sort of to something even greater than what they're saying.
Absolutely. And there's only so much leeway you have when you're interpreting the actual science in a paper, because as a reporter, you could go through that and put it into terms that the public could understand. But if you have a clip of a video or an audio that you're able to edit very creatively to spin this whatever you want, it's a lot more powerful for the public.
I disagree. No, awesome. Essentially you just said, because newspapers don't report science properly, we shouldn't report science. That's what I heard.
No.
but we're running out of time, and boy, do we have a lot more to say to this. And I'm sure Jenna will come up with an interesting, or maybe Daniel, blog entry about this, where we can have a bit more of a repartee about our particular views on this issue. But we have a very interesting interview to do by Jennifer Ouellette. I'm always worried I'm going to screw up that name. So we're going to head to that.
Right after a station ID.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Joining us now on Radio Freethinker is Science Journal's Jennifer Ouellette, whose work has appeared in The Washington Post, Discover, Salon, Nature, Physics Today, Symmetry, Physics World, and New Scientist. Jennifer was also the director of the Science and Entertainment Exchange, a Los Angeles-based initiative of the National Academy of Sciences, aimed at fostering creative collaborations between scientists and entertainment industry professionals. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So, just to clarify, you are not the Jennifer Ouellette who is a armed robber from New Hampshire.
No, no, I am not. Nor am I the woman who designs hats for the stars, you know, although she's my friend on Facebook.
Oh, excellent. And we were just talking about your ancestry is French-Canadian, and now you're an American, and your family has sown its seeds across America.
Yes, yes. I was actually born in America, and so were my folks, but their parents came from Quebec. And what's been happening over the last 100 years with that community, they've all just kind of migrated south, and now we just were everywhere.
Do you have any traditions of heritage from the Quebecois that you've kept alive?
Not me personally, but when I was growing up, we very much had the French-Canadian tradition of staying up all night. You go to a midnight mass, and then you stay up all night, and you have a feast when you get back at like 2 a.m., and then you all open the presents, and then you crash at like 5 a.m. And there's a name for it that is, the term is escaping me at the moment, but you know, there's always the Christmas log, the bouche, and things like that, bouche de Noël, and so that was definitely part of growing up, and it never occurred to me that that was at all strange or ethnic.
Right, right. Have you ever tried poutine?
Yes, yes, I have. Yes, it's, I'm really not fond of it, but my brother loved it.
Mm. Well, cheese, fries, and gravy, I mean.
I know, that's
Well, let's talk about your background, because you're actually an English major.
Yes.
And you're a science journalist now. How and why did that happen?
It happened by accident. I was living in New York City. I was trying to find my niche as a writer. New York City is probably not the best place to, like, break into writing, because everybody there wants to, like, be somebody. And I tried lots of different things. I tried being a rock and roll journalist. I tried grad school in English literature, and I didn't fit anywhere. So I took this temporary job with an organization called the American Physical Society. They're the top physics organization in the U.S. and fell in love with the topic and the people. They were wonderfully supportive, and I really credit them with giving me direction at a time when I was really floundering. I think I had always been somewhat intrigued by science, but I was one of those people that was gently nudged away from it. And for various reasons that are very complicated, because it's never as simple as blame the patriarchy. Mm-hmm. There's always a complex number of factors that come to play in order that turn people away from science and critical thinking, for that matter. But I'd always been somewhat of a skeptic. I think I'd always been that kid that was saying, but that doesn't actually make sense. You just learn not to bring it up. And it was nice to be in an environment where that was encouraged, where I got to go visit labs and I learned that real science is nothing like what you're taught in the classroom. It's asking questions. It's not knowing. It's exploring. And it's using these things that I thought were really boring and useless, like math. That's just a tool. Mm-hmm. It's a tool for exploration. It's a tool for framing a question that you can then test and answer. And once you understand that that's what science is, it comes alive for you.
I'm always curious to meet others whose background is not science, but they work in the science field. My background is history, but I do a skeptical podcast. Has your background in like the humanities and the social sciences, has that given you a different perspective, do you think, than other science journalists?
Oh, definitely. I have always, from day one, been fascinated by the history. That when you study English literature, the first thing that you do when you're studying a book from like the 17th century is you look at the culture out of which it came. You have to understand where it came from. History is absolutely essential to science because everything in science builds on what came before. It's that standing on the shoulders of giants sort of thing. And I was kind of shocked early on to find how few physicists for a long time there were actually very ignorant of their own culture's history. They understood the science, but it wasn't until they got older that they had the freedom to really, and the leisure, I think, to start exploring some of the history. So I've always used that as a storytelling tool, as a way to enliven the concepts. And I think it makes it come alive for people. And I used the same thing when I set about tackling math, and particularly my fear of calculus. I said, well, first step, where did it come from? You know, what is it that made men think that they needed something like this that, you know, inflict this suffering on high school students around the world?
I can attest to that suffering.
Yes, we all can, or at least most of us can.
Tell us a bit about the state of science journalism right now. We hear stories about newspapers cutting out science. We hear reports of journalists just sort of copying press releases. Why does this happen? What's the cause of this problem?
There's many, many causes of the problem, and although I will say that I think what's happening in science journalism is this very strange, you know, period of flux. You know, I'm trying to avoid using that cliched paradigm shift, but there's a major, major change just happening, and we're in the middle of it, which means it's uncomfortable, it's disruptive, something has to be destroyed before something new can come take its place. It's not just science journalism. When you look at what's been happening in just news and journalism in general, it's been veering more and more into entertainment. Once we got onto the 24-hour news cycle, it's exhausting to have constant copy and constant breaking news on 24/7, and people just got sloppier and sloppier about it. There's a lot of science out there. And in the age of Twitter, when people just tweet the basics in 140 characters or a quick blog post goes up, you know, or an electronic news piece, people are relying on the internet now. They're getting it faster, and other outlets can't compete. But what you have seen that gives me hope is the rise of things like science blogs, and that those are now being integrated into the media. I just moved my blog, Cocktail Party Physics, to Scientific American, but I'm hoping that some of the newspapers will also start, you know, really looking at bringing in science blogs. I think one place science blogs haven't infiltrated is some of the major newspapers, the New York Times perhaps excepted. But there you can bring in experts who are decent communicators, and they can offer context, much needed context, to the news stories. Mm-hmm. And I really like that model, and I hope it takes place, and I would like to see some of those scientists get paid for some of that, because it's a valuable skill.
Right.
And it offers something that I think people need. So I'm not necessarily pessimistic about science journalism. I'm actually kind of excited about it, but I do think it's not going to look like what it looks like or what it looked like yesterday.
Right.
And we're still figuring out what it's going to look like. The real challenge will be, will we be able to bring in the young talent and make sure that they have a living wage? And that I'm less sure of. Mm. I've always been a freelancer, because I was a humanities person, I was always told, well, it's going to be really hard to make a living. So it's not like I came into this with any expectations that I was going to be rich. But there is a tradition now in journalism of the staff reporter and the person who gets like a really nice salary and full benefits and gets to work on what they want to work on within their beat. That model is going away. Those positions are few and far between. Even established reporters are taking early buyouts because, you know, newspapers are doing the absolute worst thing they can, you know, in my opinion, which is slash the content providers.
Right.
And they're killing their quality, and that makes them even less able to compete, and we get even less quality, and that's why you get the press release.
I've always wondered if it's kind of a catch-22. Newspapers can't compete with the science of blogs and podcasts, so they lose their audience to that. But people who go to the newspapers, they don't like the quality they see, so they switch to blogs and such. So it's kind of like they're losing on both sides.
Well, I think you need to be a little careful here, because people are reading the newspaper, and only a select few are reading the blogs, the people who are already interested in science. My main worry is that science will just get increasingly, you know, ghettoized, for lack of a better word.
Mm-hmm.
And it's already, and much of what I write and what I try to do is me trying to reach the people who watch Fox News, who only watch NBC or watch, you know, The View, because those are the people that don't think science matters. They don't think they need to care about science. They think they're stupid and that they can't understand science. And they're not. A friend of mine here at the meeting was getting her nails done at the salon, and she was talking to the manicurist, and the manicurist was saying, well, I don't think I could understand science. And she sat there and says, you know, what you do for a living, this is chemistry. You know the anatomy of my fingers. You can tell when I'm getting arthritis, and you know this, this, and this, and this. That's science. And then she finally admitted, I actually really liked science when I was in high school, but the teacher told me I wasn't smart enough. And these are the people that we've lost, mm-hmm. and that we're trying to get back.
So where would you go for good science journalism?
I go to the blogs, I really do, and I look at my Twitter stream. There's a lot of people that I follow. That's where you have to go at this mm-hmm. point. I really do go to blogs, and I rely on them because that's where I see the best stories. I do subscribe to the usual press release, you know, media alerts and things like that, because one has to.
Right.
You know, it's part of my job is to be, you know, turn on the fire hose and try and pick stuff out that's of interest. But in general, the best stories don't come from that. Those are the one-off blog posts, the little newsy blog posts that you do. But for Cocktail Party Physics, I tend to do longer, context-based, with a lot of history that explore some of the science behind a news story. Right. And that's, I think, where the real value of blogs comes in.
Let's talk about your book, The Calculus Diaries. I'm afraid of calculus, I admit. So I want to know what I'm missing out on. How can calculus help me win in Vegas?
Well, I need to clarify that. I mean, we put that in the subtitle because I needed something. People are going to read calculus and say, I am never picking up that book. I says, well, if we put Vegas and zombies in the subtitle, they'll rethink their decision. And it's true, they do, which is great because it is a fun book. I think I really went out of my way to make it fun. There's no equations except in the appendix. And so what it helps you do is lose more slowly in Vegas, at least if you're playing something like craps. And I used craps because probability-wise, it's easier to handle than something like poker, because there's only two dice, and it limits some of the combinations. In craps, essentially, the house has a 1.4% edge.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an equation. A physicist named Kelly came up with it. It's called the Kelly equation. And you can plug in, you basically divide your edge by your odds, and that tells you how much of your bankroll you should bet each time for a roll of craps. The issue there, of course, is that when the house has the edge, Kelly's equation tells you to bet nothing, to not play. So I cheat a little bit, and I says, well, we're going to factor in the fun factor, and you're going to commit $100 to having fun for the next hour in playing craps. How do you lose that the as slowly as possible to maximize your fun, and that
right.
becomes an optimization problem, and that you can do. You can figure out a bell curve approach
right.
to that.
So I don't have particularly fond memories of math class. What motivated you to bring this back up?
The fact that I had horrible memories of math class, and I wrote about physics for a living, and one of my strengths, I think, as a writer who's trying to be as populist as possible, is that I remember, I know exactly what it's like to know nothing, and I rely on the concepts, and I'm not tempted to throw in equations and things because that's a real turnoff. But at some point I realized that, you know, for me, I have to understand the material much, much more deeply to break it down for a general audience than if I was writing for a very technical audience. That's a weird irony of that aspect of science writing. And I found that my understanding, like a final piece, would always click into place when I submitted and let a physicist walk me through a basic equation. And they would have to drag me kicking and screaming and says, no, really, trust me. It's not scary. It's just algebra. You'll see, and once I show this to you, you will understand perfectly why all objects follow the same rate regardless of mass. You're going to understand special relativity on a level that you would never be able to conceptually. And they were right. So I said, okay, married to a physicist. He can help me. I'm going to tackle calculus. And I would say that I went from Goo Goo Gaga to See Jane Run. I'm certainly not going to ace an AP calculus exam. That was not the point. Mm-hmm. The point was understanding what it is, where it came from, and what it's good for. And math, and calculus in particular, it really is one of the greatest intellectual human achievements, and I never appreciated that until I tackled this book. Had I not written the book, I think I would have gone through the rest of my life afraid of math.
Wow. Well, then I'm definitely going to have to read that because I am very afraid of math. Tell us about the physics of the Buffyverse.
Yeah, that was a fun little book. It's weird, and I grant people that. I mean, it's got a very limited audience. There's, if you drew a Venn diagram between physics fans and Buffy fans, the place where they overlap is very narrow indeed. So that was very much a labor of love. You know, it's not like it sold a million copies. People always assume that it was hugely popular. It's probably the least popular of all my books. But I loved writing it, and I had a lot of fun with it. And it came out because someone was laughing at me and teasing me about liking Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And they said, you know, Lawrence Krauss did the physics of Star Trek. So you could never write a book about physics in the Buffyverse. And I went, yes, you can, and I'll show you. So I wrote it on a dare, in part. And I just did this whole marathon. I went through all the episodes, and I found tons of physics. It turns out a lot of the male writers in particular on the show, and some of the women as well, were huge physics fans, huge science fans. And as part of world building, you have to figure out what the rules of your universe are. So maybe the physics there isn't like our physics, but it has to be internally consistent. And with a few glitches here and there, by and large, it is. Mm-hmm. They have a thermodynamics of magic. Magic doesn't exist in our world, and it looks ridiculous when we watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but if you watch it, there are rules. And those rules are very consistent.
Right.
In fact, by season 7 in Buffy, you have Willow, who's the star witch of the series, basically saying magic works on physics, and she cites energy conservation in particular. And I love that they took the time, and over time as they developed the series, they also developed their concept of how magic worked, and they developed rules, and that is physics.
Right, excellent. Tell us about the Science and Entertainment Exchange. What was the goal of that organization?
Well, it still exists. I spent 2 years setting it up, and then decided I really wanted to return to writing full time. But it basically is trying to build relationships between the science community and the entertainment community, and now they're starting to work to bring in the education community as well. And if you get all three of those groups together, I think that you actually could do something very powerful. The rationale is scientists are great at doing science, and they're great at the rigorous part of the teaching, but they're not great at inspiring and getting an entertaining message out, and that is something that Hollywood is genius at. Hollywood has a great need for scientific consulting. A lot of times, and it shows when they do this, they wing it on the science on some of these shows and and films, and because they don't know who to call. Mm-hmm. And it can take time to work through a university, you know, website and find the exact right person, and chances are you'll get the wrong person and they might be gruff and rude. So we've assembled essentially a database of scientists all around the country, largely in Los Angeles, because it helps if you're at least somewhat local. But if it's just a phone call, they can be anywhere. Who have expertise in a wide variety of areas, and we can do a search. We get a call from a writer or producer or director saying, you know, we've got this script and here's the scenario, and we really need to talk to someone who knows about this, but we don't actually know even what kind of scientist we should call, because it's confusing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of specialties out there, and we can figure that out. And it's been a tremendous success. Some great relationships have been developed out of that. And I always used to say that my goal was to make the exchange obsolete. To the point where when Hollywood and science didn't need us anymore, that was the goal.
Excellent.
We're not going to get there anytime soon, but I think you will slowly start to see, and you're already starting to see, even before the exchange, more science, more diverse depictions of scientists. you now have scientists on TV who are black, white, male, female, fat, small, you know, Asian, non-Asian, nerdy, not so nerdy, you know, so some of them are downright sexy, you know, they have lives, they have emotions. The pictures of scientists that the public is now getting is much more diverse. You still get the mad scientist, you still get the geek, but you get all these other things too.
Right. What are some like TV shows and movies that have done a really good job of getting the science correct, but also been entertaining and fun and exciting?
Yeah. Define correct, because they're always going to take liberties. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's something scientists need to understand, that there are certain narrative reasons why you can't. This is not a documentary, and you shouldn't. You just can't hold it to that standard.
Right.
You know, you are telling a story, and the science needs to be in service of the story, and that means that you're going to have to fudge here and there. But one of the best, honestly, is Eureka on Sci-Fi. I've just been impressed with the way they weave science into the plots. Sometimes those plots are silly, but this is sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
And what I love is their characterizations. The scientists are human beings. They're people. They have relationships. They interact. They fight. They fall in love. They break up. You know, they have kids. And you know, it's a town full of scientists and people who love and respect science.
Mm-hmm.
Their high school is called Tesla High School. And if your IQ is below 130, you're ridiculed. I mean, the jocks are like, you know, the people who get abused. It's the smart kids who are the stars. So it's a really interesting social reversal that happens when you have a community that really revers intellect and science.
Hmm. Do you know of any examples of shows and movies that have done a particularly bad job of representing science?
You can just go on the internet and find those. I mean, you can go to Bad Astronomy. You can go to a website that I like reading now, called Insultingly Stupid Movie Physics. I think The Core is famous for just having dreadful science, and Phil Plate is always going on and on about Armageddon.
Yeah.
It's like, there can't be rain and wind on an asteroid. You know, it's like... So it's not hard to find the bad science. But you can find these little nuggets where they get things right. And it's lovely when that happens. And usually they've just stumbled on something. Bones does this occasionally. I was really thrilled in a recent episode of Bones. I actually blogged about it, where the power goes out in their lab and they're trying to solve a murder and they're on a time frame. So they have to essentially cobble together, you know, as many things as they can from basic science class to get power. So they use potatoes to get batteries to get... They just need one brief flash. That's all they need.
Mm-hmm.
So they just bring in a whole bunch of potatoes from somewhere, who knows, and they do that little high school experiment where you make the battery out of the potatoes, the potassium and the reactions that take place. And they also... There was a science experiment where they essentially were able to take an X-ray using scotch tape. When you rip scotch tape, it gives off an X-ray burst, very, very brief, nanosecond X-ray burst. And it's an unusual effect. You can see it in Wintergreen Lifesavers. When you crunch those in the dark, you see that green spark, triboluminescence. This is a version of that. They used it. They actually took an X-ray using scotch tape by ripping it and getting that brief flash.
Cool.
And, of course... It's a television show. It's fantasy, so they got a perfect image.
Yeah.
That would never happen. But they were up on their science. They these are the sorts of people. People think writers, Hollywood writers, don't care about science. They read all this stuff. They found this story from 2 years ago, and they decided we're going to use that.
Yeah, excellent.
And that kind of thing is priceless.
Wow. Well, Jennifer, thank you for sharing these tales with us on Radio Free Thinker. Please join us again in the future and visit Vancouver and
The
show live.
You know, Eureka films in Vancouver, I'm just saying.
Well, there you go. Visit the cast.
When you see those outside shots, that's where it is.
Yeah.
And we're back. Thanks for that wonderful interview, Ethan. Although you couldn't be here in body, at least you were here in spirit, and we do appreciate that. And when I say in spirit, no, I don't mean the fluffy woo-woo fake spirit, but just your warm glow of essence.
That's not the same at all.
Okay, speaking of skeptic highlights, he said, switching topics desperately, I have a great skeptic highlight. Dinosaurs for the summer. We all know that global climate change will likely elevate the Earth's temperature by anywhere from 3 to 10 degrees, depending on who you listen to.
Or where you are.
Wonder what the world would look like? Well, history has already run this experiment once before during the Age of Dinosaurs. You can check out what it might have looked like by heading down to Science World for their Dinosaur Extreme exhibit. Get a look at what life was like in the dinosaurian past. While there, check out the air-conditioned theater and see Dinosaurs Alive at the OmniMax Theater. Daily shows at noon and 2 p.m. That's $5 to get in there. I forget how much Science World is to get in there. But I thought it would just be cool. I mean, everyone's going out to the park. Screw the park. Can't learn anything there. Go to Science World.
You can learn stuff at the park.
Okay.
Wasn't our skeptic highlight last week about learning stuff in the park?
Yes. It was evolution in the park.
Oh, I love it when my memory doesn't fail me. Well, in the spirit of wishing that Ethan was here today, I'm going to let people know about his skeptic highlight, which is a documentary called The Cave of Forgotten Dreams. And this is a documentary that's produced by Werner Herzog. My German is phenomenal. Exploring the Chauvet Caves of southern France, where the oldest forms of cave paintings exist. And we'll have a link up on our show notes for the show times.
Awesome.
Quite cool, too, actually. I like some of the thoughts about that, how the cave paintings are, whether they're actually paintings as we think about it, or whether it's a like early form of written communication. Like, I mean, it was actually sort of their form of language, written language. But speaking of other interesting things?
Yes. If you are in the Vancouver area and you'd like some wieners and burgers, the UBC Freethinkers are going to have their annual summer barbecue. It's at Jericho Beach. Because last time people went all over Jericho Beach. It's Jericho Beach West near the Sailing Club. This is Saturday, August 20th, starting at 5:30. So come join us for barbecue and good times.
I highly recommend to any of our Christian friends out there, if you're worried about your soul burning forever, come out, enjoy the free thinkers, and then you only have to worry about your wiener burning. This is Dawn saying, eyes open, minds on.
This is Jenna saying that maybe you should always worry about whether or not your wiener's burning.
This is Daniel saying, come join us at the barbecue.
Bye.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting like more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
It's only a dream.
Power Chord, every Saturday from 1 to 3 p.m. here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
This is Naomi Shelton and the Gospel Queens of Brooklyn. You are listening to 101.9 FM, CITR.